All right. Welcome, listeners, to this very special bonus episode of Know Your Enemy. I'm Matt Sittman, one of your podcast co-hosts, and I'm not here with my friend Sam. I'm doing an interview today, just me and Eric Rauchway, who's the author of a new book, Why the New Deal Matters, just out from Yale University Press. Welcome to Know Your Enemy, Eric.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. I've been looking forward to this. Our listeners, I'm sure a lot of them are familiar with your work, but for those who aren't, who are you, Eric?
My name is Eric Rauchway. I'm a distinguished professor of history at the University of California, Davis. If you don't know where Davis is, it's in the northern-ish part of California, not too far from Sacramento. I've been doing this gig here since 2001. I've been in the general racket since 1996 when I got my PhD at Stanford. And I'm the author of 7 books on U.S. history, lately focusing more on the period of the 1930s and 1940s, also of a novel.
I didn't know that.
It's a well-kept secret. It's called Banana Republican, and It's about the adventures of an American capitalist in Central America in the 1920s, a character named Tom Buchanan, who's previous adventures you may know from a little book called The Great Gatsby. So it's a taking him off in a new direction.
Oh, great. When did Winter War come out?
Winter War came out in 2018, and that was about the sort of 1932-33 conflict between Franklin Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover over the New Deal. And then the new book is just out a couple weeks ago, and it's called Why the New Deal Matters, from Yale University Press.
Well, I thought we'd start by talking about your new book. I'm sure your publisher will be happy about that. And I encourage all of our listeners to pick up a copy, not from Amazon, but from someplace else if you can. It was really a pleasure to read. And just right off the bat, I want to say it was beautifully written, I thought, and very moving in places. You know, part of the distinctive way it's written is the structure of the book. And that was one of the first things I wanted to ask you about, just because, you know, it's part of a series from Yale University Press that's called, what, Why X Matters? So you had to explain why the New Deal matters. And you did it by kind of taking us on a tour of maybe 4 or 5 locations. Could you tell us what they are and kind of how you arrived at writing the book this way rather than, I mean, there's innumerable ways you could have explained why the New Deal matters. How did you pick the way you did?
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words about the book and the writing. I appreciate that. That's always nice to hear, especially as I'm sure you know, people often tell you other things about your work. So, it's nice to hear. I think a lot of us know, certainly the kind of people who buy University Press books, know that the New Deal has a legacy that we could sort of gesture at. A lot of people know that they can probably visit a New Deal public work not too far from them, usually something fairly grand, like, you know, the Triborough Bridge, let's say, or something like that. People are aware of WPA art and murals, some of which have found their way into museums. And so people think of the New Deal as something you could maybe visit. I wanted to impress upon people the way that it's really sort of pervasive in all of our lives, no matter where we are in the United States, pretty much no matter who we are. I mean, I think the real challenge really is to try to go through your day without dealing with the legacy of the New Deal. So that's what I wanted to point out.
Well, the way you begin the book, I mentioned the different places you take us, and we'll talk about them in turn. But it begins very cleverly with a description of anxious Americans in the midst of a long winter, isolated, kind of facing an invisible enemy that could kind of strike them at any moment. And in this kind of winter of discontent, they make a political decision to try something new. Of course, you could start reading that and think you're talking about the pandemic. But, you know, really, you're talking about the winter of 1932. And you say this: the New Deal mattered then at the cusp of spring in 1933, because it gave Americans permission to believe in a common purpose that was not war. Neither before nor since have Americans so rallied around an essentially peaceable form of patriotism. The results of that effort remain with us in forms both concrete and abstract. The New Deal therefore matters still because Americans can scarcely get through a day without coming into contact with some part of it. You go on to describe the New Deal as being like the water a fish swims in. It's so much around us. It affects so many parts of our lives, that we forget about it.
If you, for example, have a bank account, many of us do, it would be insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is, of course, a legacy of the New Deal. If you've ever used that bank account to take out a small business loan, that's a legacy of the New Deal. If you've used it to buy a house, that's a legacy of the New Deal, the national mortgage market. If you've, in fact, ever handled any bill of the United States currency, the dollar that we have today is a product of the very first days of the New Deal, when Roosevelt took the dollar off the gold standard and inaugurated a policy of monetary policy to counteract economic downturns. But that's just the kind of straightforward financial aspects of the New Deal, which is, as I say, pervasive and worth beginning with. But, you know, we can move on from there to say that, you know, any part of the country, almost any part of the country you're in, if you're on a road or a street or near a sidewalk, you are either on or connected to something that was built by the New Deal. In many parts of the country, when you turn on the switch to bring electricity into your house, you are dealing with a grid that was built by the New Deal, and quite possibly with generating power that was created by the New Deal. If you live near or on lands of a Native nation in the United States, the Indian New Deal, as it was called, ended the 19th century policy of allotment and started restoring ancestral lands to the Native nations, which were granted new sovereignty under the terms of the New Deal. If you eat any product of American agriculture, you are dealing with the legacy of the New Deal and the program to kind of revive American farmers. If you have ever had any kind of relationship with almost any part of the American economy, as I say, you know, you're dealing in one way or another with the New Deal. And that's, again, just sort of an introductory go at it. You could keep going. You could even point out that outside the United States, the world economy is structured by the New Deal because of the IMF and the other Bretton Woods institutions.
Yeah. And to kind of, you know, give the answer why the New Deal matters, or to kind of put flesh on the bones of these claims you're making about all the ways, you know, we interact with the New Deal and its legacy, you take us through four different places. The first is Arlington National Cemetery. The second is the Clinch River in Tennessee. Third is Window Rock, the capital city of the Navajo people in Arizona. Hunter's Point in the San Francisco Bay Area. And the final chapter, other than the conclusion, is called The Street Where You Live, which is great. And it gets at that point. I did not realize that so many sidewalks were built by the New Deal. But the way you begin the kind of start into chapter one at Arlington National Cemetery, I'll just betray my own ignorance here. I feel like, you know, in general, I'm aware of U.S. political history. I feel like the bonus march, which really is kind of where you go in that chapter that starts at Arlington National Cemetery, I feel like the importance of it was not impressed upon me, kind of, you know, in high school history classes, or the kind of generic sense you have of the flow of history in the 20th century. And I especially didn't, I think it's actually in your book, Winter War, but you have a line where you say that Hoover saw in the bonus march, the bonus army, communism, but what FDR saw in it was fascism. I wondered if you could just, maybe for our listeners who need a refresher like I did, could you kind of talk about that first chapter, and especially the importance of the bonus march, the bonus army, and kind of the differing responses to it between Hoover and FDR?
You opened very kindly by quoting that bit from the beginning of the book about the invisible enemy in 1932-33. And in honor, of course, of this being Know Your Enemy, we should point out that the invisible enemy there is fascism. And that's what's looming behind a lot of Franklin Roosevelt's thinking and the thinking of other New Dealers during the 1930s, that the Great Depression is not just an economic crisis, it's a political crisis. Because with these 4 years, essentially, of deflation, you know, cruelly falling prices, which make it unprofitable to harvest crops and make it impossible, therefore, for farmers to make a living, farm workers to make a living, to pay their mortgages. On the other hand, increasing unemployment in cities with people literally starving, even as those crops are rotting in the fields. It's very easy to look around and say, you know, representative government has failed, you know, especially when the president of the United States, in this case, is Herbert Hoover, who adamantly believes that it is not his job to intervene either to prop up the banks or to provide aid to the unemployed. So that's the background for the summer of 1932, when some thousands, maybe as many as a couple of tens of thousands of veterans of the Great War came from all parts of the country, really beginning in the West Coast, in Portland, Oregon, and other West Coast cities, hitching rides, you know, hopping freights, whatever, to get across the country to Washington, D.C. So this is a time before we have regular veterans benefits, right? So they are owed, in exchange for their service in the Great War, a lump sum payment that's due in 1945, as it happens. And they decide, well, in as much as we're all out of work and could use the cash, could we have it now, please? And they are going to ask, that's what they're going to Congress for. And that lump sum is referred to as the bonus. So that's why they're called the Bonus March, the Bonus Army, or the Bonus Expeditionary Force, after the American Expeditionary Force that went to Europe. So they come and they get there, and they're initially greeted, you know, with some degree of assistance by the Washington, D.C. City Police, the chief of which, Pelham Glassford, you know, was an officer in the Great War. And he helps them organize tent cities, both in the Mall and on the Anacostia Flats, and some of them encamp in abandoned buildings in the city, abandoned public buildings in the city. And they're there, as I say, initially to petition Congress for a payment of the bonus early. The House passes it. The Senate turns it down. Hoover said he would veto it anyway, even if the Senate had passed it.
Right.
But then they stay. I mean, this is the critical thing. They stay, and they really dig in. They have, you know, kind of a regular camp in which they enforce their own order. They spend their days drilling, because remember, these are former soldiers, and they march in protest. They have a newspaper, which we can still read. That's where you begin to see that this kind of inchoate discontent really could have gone in dangerous directions, because there's a lot of, you know, Congress doesn't work for us, it's corrupt, we need to overthrow it. You know, the sort of self-appointed leader of the Bonus Army was a man named Walter Waters, who, as one of his allies said, was a, you know, a good solid right winger. Many of the marchers, many of the marchers called him a fascist. He wanted to turn the Bonus Army into what he called a movement of khaki shirts, which he explicitly modeled on the Italian black shirts of Mussolini or the German brown shirts of Hitler. And so, as I say, you can see that this is, you know, potentially an incipient right. And remember, this 32, the summer when the Nazi Party is finally, you know, making its big inroads in the Reichstag, and Hitler will become chancellor in January of 33. So there's a global shift towards the right that a lot of people are aware of.
And this Walter Waters character, his role as leader of the Bonus Army, in your book, you say that he demanded, quote, complete dictatorial powers over the Bonus Army, which is, it's not a great thing to hear.
It is not a great thing to hear. And, you know, again, he's following a playbook that he sees already underway. There are veterans organizations in France that are similarly right-wing at this time that are proposing a coup against the Social Democrats. And, you know, that's the direction in which things seem to be going. So what happens is ultimately that Herbert Hoover tells the chief of staff of the army, Douglas MacArthur, who we will later encounter in many other guises, to get rid of them. And MacArthur uses tanks and cavalry, headed by George Patton, as it happens, and tear gas to run off the marchers. The army isn't actually responsible for the two deaths of the veterans that occur. That's the Washington City Police. They are probably responsible for the death of an infant when they are using tear gas to drive off the forces. MacArthur mutinies against Hoover. That is to say, Hoover sees this going on, can tell it looks bad, as we would say nowadays, the optics are not good, and you know, tells MacArthur to quit. And MacArthur disobeys this order, which is given twice within the hearing of Dwight Eisenhower, again, somebody we would encounter later, and, you know, burns out all of the encampments and then later lies about what he's done. So that sketch, I think, helps us to understand, first of all, why this is a big deal, because this is on all the newsreels, which is the closest thing you're going to get to the evening news in those days. Americans see it, and they see these folks, you know, who are veterans. They went on the crusade to make the world safe for democracy. And they're petitioning their representative government, and now they're being beaten up and run off by the army. So that's not good, because Americans identify rather with the veterans than with Doug MacArthur. Hoover and MacArthur lie. They say that these guys are communists, that they're probably not veterans, and, you know, they couldn't possibly have been allowed to stay for any longer. And that tells you sort of where they're coming from. Hoover doesn't believe in using the powers of the federal government to help Americans who are suffering. He does believe in using them to punish Americans who are petitioning their government. Right. Roosevelt, by contrast, views this episode and has a number of conversations about it, but one of them that we know about is with his aide, Rex Tugwell, where it inspires him to say that, look, there are two really dangerous lessons we can see at work here, that there are two really dangerous men in America, and they represent two different kinds of possibilities in terms of fascist movements. One of them, Roosevelt says, is Huey Long, who you may know is a sort of charismatic and authoritarian figure in Louisiana politics. And if somebody like Huey Long could lead a discontented populist movement like that, it could very well lead to a fascist takeover. And the other threat he sees is the threat of Doug MacArthur, which is to say that, you know, the rich folks in America might back such a person in the hopes of stamping out dissent in the name of preventing communism from arising.
Yes.
So Roosevelt really sees that as crystallizing the fascist threat or threats that face America at that point. Mm-hmm. It's worth pointing out that, you know, almost as soon as Roosevelt becomes president, one of the things he does immediately after bailing out the banks and stuff is establish the first of a series of public works agencies called the Civilian Conservation Corps. And this is aimed, of course, at doing, you know, reforestation and other environmentally sound work, but it's also aimed at hiring the possible constituency for a dangerous fascist movement. That is to say, it's aimed at unemployed young men, right?
And right.
It's also specifically extended to veterans of the Great War. A number of the bonus marchers say, we're going to come back and we're going to petition again and we're going to, you know, target Roosevelt's administration. Mm-hmm. And Walter Waters says, we don't need to do that. And the New Deal is now addressing, you know. So you can see that Roosevelt's programs are immediately sort of defusing right-wing threats, which is what Roosevelt means them to do.
It's really a great way to open the book. I mean, it kind of sets up, as you're getting at, the stakes right away and kind of drops the reader into a tense situation that made me more aware of what was happening in that moment and the kind of really terrible possibilities that Roosevelt, among others, saw lurking there. One of the things I don't mean to, you know, get us too far away from your current book, but maybe we could take a step back and talk about how your understanding of Roosevelt maybe differs from common interpretations, you know, the kind of semi-mythological high school history book stories that get handed down to us, right? And in particular, as someone on the left, I think I've often thought about Roosevelt from the perspective of the left, meaning he saved capitalism from itself, right? He was a more moderate alternative to more radical, you know, left-wing critiques of the Great Depression, our system of government, so on and so forth. But you really establish his status as an anti-fascist thinker and the imperative to save democracy. Jamel Bowie wrote a great column about this, praising your book, where he underscored the New Deal wasn't just about saving the economy. It was about kind of restabilizing and strengthening American democracy. You know, how does that, your line on Roosevelt, differ from maybe some of the other interpretations that listeners might be familiar with?
Well, thank you again for your kind words. There is a left critique, of course, of Roosevelt that begins during the 30s. You know, the United States had then not only a Communist Party, but also a Socialist Party under the leadership of Norman Thomas, who later became a principal opponent of Roosevelt's anti-fascist foreign policy and rather unfortunately, you know, shared stages with Charles Lindbergh of the America First movement and things like that. But earlier in the 30s, Thomas was upset with Roosevelt because, as one reporter asked Thomas famously, isn't President Roosevelt just carrying out the socialist agenda? And Thomas said, yes, on a stretcher. He understood that the popularity and the material success and the ideological success of the New Deal had totally destroyed any felt need for more radical forms of American politics, or that was how he understood it. And certainly there is a strain of history, especially coming out of the so-called New Left of the 1960s and early 1970s, which sort of castigates Roosevelt for not being left enough, for being, you know, the great savior of capitalism, which I suppose is fair enough. I mean, factually, that's what occurred. I think it's also worth pointing out that, you know, Roosevelt didn't give that much of a fuss about any particular, you know, capitalism or socialism. He had a very, I think it's fair to say, humanitarian philosophy. You know, not to put a fine point on it, he was a deeply Christian person. Mm-hmm. If you look at his rhetoric, it is just shot through with the language of the King James Bible in almost all of his speeches, you know, and in many cases, it's quite well deployed. I think because it was sincere.
Even phrases like the money changers.
Right, you know? right.
That's right out of, you know, Jesus in the Temple.
Right. No, it's absolutely right in that ballpark. And that's right from the beginning. In fact, there was a church association that took Roosevelt's first inaugural and annotated it, pointing out all of the references to, all the ways in which it could be seen as an exegesis of the Gospels.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
And again, I think it's mostly instinctive on his part. I mean, because he's just so steeped in that from his, you know, his education at Groton, his sort of his Episcopal belief, that's just where he came from. And in as much as he had a philosophy, it was one that he articulated on a number of occasions, but most notably when he accepted the renomination of the Democratic Party in 1936, you know, he borrowed from, he said, an English jurist who said, necessitous men are not free men, right? And that, you know, we need to not be, you know, at the coalface all the time if we want to be able to make free decisions about how to live our lives. You know, that's later sort of even further crystallized into one of the four freedoms during the Second World War, which is freedom from want, right? That needs to be one of the organizing principles of the post-war world if we're going to defeat fascism, right? So that's Roosevelt's sort of general philosophy. But again, he's very explicit about what I've just said to you, or what you've suggested is my take on him, is by saying, speaking, by the way, of the King James Bible, again, in that 1936 speech at Philadelphia, he says, we need to build our program around faith, hope, and charity. And, you know, again, not subtle, but the faith part is faith in democracy in a world of dictatorships. Keeping in mind that American democracy at this time is severely flawed, and will be so even once Roosevelt gets through with it, it's still, you know, as he would say, better than dictatorship, and we need to kind of reinvigorate people's faith that the government can work for the ordinary citizen and not just for the rich and powerful. And that's how I think you have to see the New Deal. So there was, as I said, there was a left critique of the New Deal, which is kind of, it wasn't socialist, which fair enough, it wasn't. But there's also a right critique of the New Deal that really became mainstreamed in the 1970s and 80s with what regular listeners of Know Your Enemy will know as the neoliberal era. And it's, oh, the New Deal didn't work. That if you look at the New Deal as Keynesian stimulus, it's never big enough. That, you know, it takes the war to provide the necessary stimulus to relieve unemployment, about which I would say, you know, two things. I mean, number one, stipulating that that's true, it's a really dumb thing to say. Not, again, to be kind of blunt. If you're saying that it took the war to provide a big enough stimulus, then what you're saying is when the government set about hiring Americans to build tanks and airplanes, it was able to eradicate long-term and large unemployment. All you're saying is, well, the government could have done that earlier, getting Americans to build roads and bridges and schools and stadiums and, you know, new forests and national parks, if there had been, you know, the political will. So all you're saying is the New Deal should have been bigger sooner, not that the New Deal didn't work.
Right.
The other thing that's wrong with that is, of course, the New Deal did work, even if it was anemic compared to an appropriate Keynesian stimulus. Presidents don't get elected with record landslide margins the way that Franklin Roosevelt did in 1936 if they have failed to address the problems they were elected to address. You know, Roosevelt won in 36, by historians like to note, by the greatest margin since James Monroe ran unopposed. It's and the swing towards the Democrats in 36 was greatest in areas where they had seen the most rapid and effective economic recovery. So you know, the whole right-wing thing about how the New Deal didn't work is based on obfuscation and just incorrect application. But as you also say, it sidesteps what Roosevelt and his fellow New Dealers, like Harold Dickies, Harry Hopkins, Francis Perkins, Robert Wagner, etc., would have understood to be the real point of the New Deal, which was to save not capitalism, but democracy.
Yes.
Roosevelt wasn't really interested in the fastest possible recovery, if by that you mean going back to the way things were. And again, he explicitly says this. You know, he says, I have my doubts about how good the good old days were. You know, we need to go forward to new and better days. That the New Deal would have been a failure if it had merely had a rapid recovery to the former economy. It really needed to have a broad recovery that involved the most possible people.
And while we're on this point, I've also learned from your books, especially Winter War, although I think it comes through in your current book too as well, that, you know, there's one of these kind of popular understandings of Roosevelt is that the New Deal was, well, it wasn't really a plan. It wasn't a coherent approach. And it was just pragmatic, throwing things against the wall to see what stuck. It wasn't a sort of well thought out philosophy that, you know, Roosevelt had defined and articulated, you know, while running for office. It was more, we're just going to try things and see how it goes and see what sticks. But you portray Roosevelt as a much more kind of coherent thinker in the sense of actually the New Deal was something he really did make arguments on behalf of and, you know, define, if not overly explicitly, pretty thoroughly. And then when Americans voted for him, it really was a vote for the coherent alternative he was offering.
Yeah, and again, I think this says more about the kinds of people who wrote about Roosevelt in, you know, after his death than it does about the actual New Deal, which is to say, you know, almost no sooner does Roosevelt die than the country, you know, takes off into the Cold War. And anti-fascism gets left behind in the name of pursuing anti-communism, right? So in the era of anti-communism, it is especially important for Americans to disavow any idea of central planning. So it becomes almost virtuous to say, well, I don't really have a plan or an ideology. I'm just going to do this and do that. I'm very pragmatic. And that's the language with which people sort of lionized Roosevelt in the 40s and then later came to criticize him as time wore on, that he didn't really have an agenda. Mm-hmm. And they kind of absorbed, you know, what had been a Republican talking point, especially in the run-up to the 36 election. You know, the Republicans deliberately decided to craft a message in 35 and 36 that Roosevelt had run as a kind of, you know, vague centrist and then had presided as a hard left type, and therefore he had betrayed the people who voted for him. But if you look at the speeches that Roosevelt and Hoover gave in 1932, it is crystal clear that that is nonsense.
That there really was a kind of clearly defined choice.
Yeah. Roosevelt really from the beginning said, we're going to do, and then he would list things off. Now, that doesn't mean that they necessarily form a coherent ideology or whatever, but he was clear about what he was going to do, that in order to counteract the Depression, they were going to have a massive program of public works. And that was going to not only employ people, but it was going to promote economic development. And he gestured at the great dams that were already being built in Boulder Canyon, which the Hoover administration had named after President Hoover. And the one that had already been built at Muscle Shoals in Alabama on the Tennessee River. And he said these could become the foundations for whole systems to provide electricity to people who don't have it. Mm-hmm. And also to rethink how we promote prosperity as a people. So he basically promised the kinds of things that he would later deliver in those areas. He campaigned on the program of reforestation and employment that became the Civilian Conservation Corps. He promised that he would lower tariffs. He promised, you know, that he would help to raise the prices of agricultural commodities by using methods that were then being described to sort of subsidize farmers. These are things, of course, that were implemented and remain still with us. He talked about coordinating industrial planning. I mean, there's almost no element of the New Deal as it was actually implemented, with the possible exception of sort of systematic public housing that Roosevelt didn't talk about in the campaign of 1932. Oh, and it's worth pointing out, Hoover, of course, campaigned against all of those things, you know, saying that they were going to put the country on the road to Moscow. So yes. It was very easy to see, you know, with you reelected Hoover, you're going to get more of the same. I mean, he said this, we'll raise the tariff again. That's what he promised. He absolutely opposed public power initiatives and regulatory initiatives of the kind that Roosevelt was proposing. And he said that the public works program, which of course was the centerpiece of the New Deal, was going to crack the timbers of the Constitution. So you knew what you were getting, I think, if you were even moderately aware of what they were campaigning on.
It really is remarkable. The speeches and comments from Hoover, conversations he had that you cite in both your current book, Why the New Deal Matters and Winter War, I don't want to say it's amusing because it's depressing, but it's really remarkable how the rhetoric has not really been updated since then on the right. I feel almost silly pointing it out, but it's really true. You hear Hoover, you know, barking on and on about socialism, the road to Moscow, you know, as you say, cracking the timber of the Constitution. It sounds like a speech that any number of contemporary Republicans could give.
I think that's true. And I think completely apart from anything I have contributed to people's understanding about Roosevelt, I hope I have contributed to people's understanding that Herbert Hoover is properly understood as the father of modern conservatism. That if you want the big daddy of all of this stuff, you have to go back to Hoover. You know, Hoover is the king of opposing the New Deal without actually arguing against any specific one of its initiatives, you know, which is this is commonplace because he expressly said, this was actually in the context of the Upson Sinclair campaign for governor in 1934, but he expressly said, unfortunately, the voters probably agree with him on economic issues. So we have to appeal to religion instead, you know, to oppose him. I mean, again, Hoover is the architect of that playbook. He published this book, which he privately referred to as the Ark of the Covenant. It's actually called The Challenge to Liberty, where he never even mentions, you know, the New Deal or Roosevelt. It's just over and over again about how important it is to protect liberty. He, without the pithiness, but does say that, you know, we need to preserve selfishness as a motive. In other words, that greed is good. And Barry Goldwater would later say that this was the book that crystallized his political thinking. You know, Hoover really is the founding father of the modern conservative movement.
Just as you've clarified a number of things about FDR for me, same with Hoover, I was also struck by his kind of stubbornness. And like, you know, in 1932, aides would come to him and say they think he was losing and he didn't want to hear it. Could you just tell us more about like that period, the 1932 election, and was Hoover surprised he lost? And then after he did lose, I mean, part of Winter War is that at the time, presidents weren't inaugurated, right, until March, I believe?
That's right.
So the kind of intervening period between an election in November and then Roosevelt actually taking office, you know, there was a greater span of time there than exists now, a few months. What was happening during that period of time?
There are a lot of misconceptions about Hoover, and Hoover is responsible for most of them. I think you have to understand that this is a man who survived his defeat for the presidency in 1932 by another 32 years. You know, he lived until 1964. And in fact, when he was asked late in life how he had won so many of the arguments he had with political opponents, he said, "I outlived the bastards." Hoover lived a long life. He was gifted with public relations, and he was extremely wealthy. And his major project, which he pursued through what is now the Hoover Institution at Stanford, was then the Hoover Library on War and Revolution, was to promote his legacy. So people know about Hoover's successes, I think, especially during the time of World War I, when he was in charge of relief to the starving people of Belgium, that he was later made food administrator by the Wilson administration. And then after the war, he was in charge of a relief effort to revolutionary Russia to save peoples of what would be the Soviet Union from starvation, all of which he was pretty good at, you know, by all accounts. And that even later, when he was Secretary of Commerce in 1927-28, that he was in charge of the flood relief effort in the Mississippi River Valley after the Great Flood of that time. And we could talk about the inadequacies of that, but I don't think we want to go too far afield. But, you know, here was somebody who at least appeared to have a track record of success as a manager of crises. In fact, in his campaign film in 1928, it was called Master of Emergencies. That's who you were electing. Mm-hmm. So how did he turn out to be such a catastrophe in managing the Great Depression? As you've suggested, Hoover himself couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that he was failing. Almost from the beginning, you know, he believed that what he was going to do, which was to sort of use public relations to kind of boost people's confidence in the business community and rally businessmen to kind of self-sacrifice, that that was going to work. And then he was persuaded that it had worked. And then even when everyone came to him, including his, you know, sort of hand-picked presidential commissions on unemployment, you know, which was headed by Walter Gifford, who was the CEO of AT&T, so not a noted socialist or anything, came to him and said, you need to have a federal program to meet the unemployment crisis. You know, Hoover just dismissed them out of hand, refused to believe them. I just think Hoover couldn't believe that he hadn't been successful. So then he campaigned as a great success in 1932, which is one of the reasons he lost so badly, because the average citizen wasn't persuaded by this. And then the flip side of that is he believed, I think sincerely, that the New Deal couldn't possibly succeed. And therefore, as you've suggested, he spent the months of his, you know, between his loss and the beginning of Roosevelt's presidency, trying to prevent Roosevelt from implementing the New Deal. You know, he said, let's appoint a commission to sign a determined policy, you know, he's hoping that that would tie Roosevelt's hands. He tried to pin the whole thing, the continuing economic crisis, on Roosevelt. I mean, specifically, there had been, you know, waves of bank failures right through Hoover's presidency, and there was a severe one that began in the summer of 32 and continued right through the end of 32 and into 33. And Hoover just started blaming that on Roosevelt and saying only Roosevelt could stop this by forswearing the New Deal. And, you know, he tried to get him to do that. And he tried to get other people to get him to do that. And Roosevelt, for his part, said, I will not do that. I'm paraphrasing here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he said, this is what I was elected to do, and I'm going to go ahead and do it. So Hoover went out extremely disappointed, I think it's fair to say, and never got over it.
I'm interested in, well, I'd mentioned the way Hoover's rhetoric lines up so well with, you know, the rhetoric we hear today on the right. How does the right view Hoover right now? Because I've noticed, like, Amity Schles, right? She wrote the kind of revisionist, you know, right-wing history of the New Deal called, I think, Forgotten Man. But she recently came out with a biography of Coolidge. And I'm kind of wondering if the conservatives are going to work their way back to Hoover and try to vindicate him, too. You know, they're kind of working their way through, you know, early 20th century presidents. You know, they have the anti-Wilson stuff at the Claremont Institute. You know, we have the pro-Coolidge books. Are we going to get, you know, a kind of reconsideration of Hoover as a prophet not welcomed in his own country or something? The man who foresaw socialism or the like.
Well, I think it's a tough row to hoe, because the sort of nonsense interpretation of Herbert Hoover that has prevailed, you know, specifically starting in the Cold War period, is to understand him as a fella who kind of was a progressive, as one of the biographies of Hoover says, who tried hard, but circumstances were against him. And, you know, really what he had done was pretty good. And that's the source of Amity Schles' unhappiness with him, is because she sees him as a kind of proto-New Dealer, you know, too interventionist in the economy. And that's why he's not as good as Coolidge in her mind. I'm not the only one who understands that this is a nonsense view of Herbert Hoover. I would quote the great dean of New Deal historians, still plying the trade, William Luchtenberg, who said in his most recent book about the American presidents that it is a mistake to understand Herbert Hoover as a passive president. He was extremely active in seeking to curb the power of the federal government. You would have to recover Hoover, the proto-modern conservative, you know, as somebody who really sought to circumscribe the power of Washington to do things. And then you would have to say, and that was the right policy in the Depression, which is, it's hard.
I want to get to some other parts of why the New Deal matters, especially your chapters on Window Rock and Hunter's Point. But before we kind of move in that direction, there was something I just wanted to ask you, because it stood out to me reading Why the New Deal Matters. And it's the way Roosevelt talked about work. You know, you really impressed upon us the importance of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Progress Administration, so on and so forth, that Roosevelt had this, thought there was a dignity to work. And it, he seemed to prefer giving people a job to sometimes direct cash payments, I guess we'd say now. It's interesting to me in part because right now during the pandemic, you know, there's been so much debate about the $2,000 checks, right? those kind of direct putting money in the bank. It was something that stood out to me, and I wondered if you could talk about that some.
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, if you look at sort of the modern discussion of federal relief to the unemployed or the underemployed, Roosevelt definitely would have been team jobs guarantee rather than team just write checks. That said, I think, you know, the circumstances are important. I think Roosevelt was not an idiot, and he would have understood that in a time when people can't work, you have to just provide cash, especially given the infrastructure where the economy today, in a way that was not true in the 30s, could be carried on, you know, at a distance, for at least for many people. And Roosevelt's programs, both when he was governor of New York State, it's worth pointing out, you know, when he was governor of New York State during the Depression, he was the most activist proponent of the most activist responses to the Depression, even before becoming president. So again, people knew who they were voting for. Mm-hmm. You know, his relief program at the state level provided in-kind aid, you know, home relief and in-kind aid to Americans who, for whatever reason, couldn't work. And, you know, later during the New Deal, it was the same kind of thing, that the works programs would employ women specifically to do sort of gender-prescribed work like sewing and canning, and that was to provide clothing and food to people who wouldn't otherwise have it. And of course, Roosevelt, for personal as well as political reasons, understood the need of aid to people with disabilities, so that, you know, the Social Security Act had, you know, sort of the seed, the first federal relief to the disabled. And so he understood the need, you know, for payments to people who were unable to work. But where there was the ability to work and where there was work to be done, as you say, he was adamantly in favor of hiring people rather than what he called a dole. Mm-hmm. You know, as you say, partly this is the dignity of work that is reflected in the histories we have of Americans during the Depression, that people generally would have preferred to work. They wanted to work. They wanted to have a job. People are given identities quite often by their jobs, or at least by the fact of having one. And Roosevelt understood that. But again, more importantly, to come back to a theme that we've sounded a couple times, Roosevelt thought that for the government directly to hire people would help reinvigorate people's faith that the government worked for them, that as they worked for the government, they would see that the government was working for them. Huh. And then, of course, the kinds of projects that New Deal agencies undertook, you know, helped to create a public sphere or a civic space or a sense of the nation as something that we share that was vital to the New Deal's sort of reinvigorated concept of democracy.
Yeah, it's that sense of a public square. One of the really beautiful parts of why the New Deal matters is you talk about the library at UC Davis and theaters and libraries and public spaces like that. That's a really kind of fascinating thing for me because it's, you know, that kind of public sphere, as you're describing it, it had to be created, which means it has to be sustained. How did Roosevelt think about that? You have the great quote that we build monuments to things we think are beautiful or important. And, you know, something like a library, it says something about a society if they're willing, you know, to keep using that language to build a monument to reading and books.
Right. Again, not to make the obvious point, but at a time when, for example, Nazis were burning books, right, that the commitment to preserving and enshrining them means something that much more, again, given that context. This is essential to the idea, not just of Roosevelt, but again, of other New Dealers, particularly Harry Hopkins, who features prominently in the book as well, that, you know, what you needed was for people to build things that create a sense of national identity that, as you kindly pointed out, is not rooted in going to war, but rather is sort of rooted in the life that we share. Hopkins was the one who was most keen on funding arts, you know, not just visual arts, but performing arts and music. And he thought of it specifically as fostering that kind of communal experience that you're describing. I mean, he, from the veriest early days of the New Deal, wanted to fund musicians because they enabled people to gather together in public and to kind of enjoy themselves, you know, and that this was his concept of what the New Deal should be doing. So when we think about those arts programs, we need to think of them not only as giving work to artists, but again, to creating a culture, you know, that Americans could be proud of, and that would, again, promote democracy by being a democratic culture. I don't know where you live, but I'm reasonably certain there remains some New Deal art near you, and dollars to donuts, it valorizes work in some way. You know, if you see those murals, the ones that are nearest me in San Francisco, like, for example, in Coit Tower, you know, they're all a bunch about daily life and what ordinary Americans do to get a living, also how they spend their time in leisure. The ones in Coit Tower are really wonderful because they show, you know, they show fishermen, they show news agents, they show industrial workers and agricultural workers. But then they also show working class people in libraries, you know, and probably to put a thumb in somebody's eye, the working class person is taking down a volume of Marx.
There's really?
Yes.
Yeah, so, that's great.
All the books on the bookshelf are
slip that in
communist
there.
Stuff. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting, especially in the context of if you look closely at that mural, you can see that the one of the newspaper's headlines refers to the destruction of the mural that Diego Rivera painted for Rockefeller Center. And so this mural is kind of challenging that, because this is publicly funded art and no billionaire can come along and tell you to take it down, even though it's got, you know, Marx Capital right in the middle of it.
That's great. You know, I mentioned that two of the other chapters in your Why the New Deal Matters, the kind of places you take us, are Window Rock, Arizona, the capital city of the Navajo people, and Hunters Point, San Francisco. And I thought they were interesting because, I mean, I think right now a kind of rightful critique of the New Deal for its limits in terms of racial justice is something I feel like I've heard more about recently than I ever have before. It's kind of a, for various reasons, I think certain books have come out. It's obviously connects to some of our current debates about class and race and those kinds of matters. The two chapters I just mentioned were interesting because the one in Window Rock, Arizona, I did not know any of that history of the role the New Deal played in Indian country, in our treatment of Native Americans. And then the Hunters Point chapter, to me, was a really fascinating exploration of the extent that the New Deal appealed to African Americans, the inroads Roosevelt and the Democratic Party made, and in some cases did not make, with African Americans as voters. What were you going for with those two chapters?
It's important to remember that Roosevelt used language that we would find familiar, that is to say, of broadening social justice, right? That this was the basic idea that you were going to improve the lives of more different kinds of Americans than ever had been addressed before. And I wanted to bring that out by talking about attempts the New Deal made in that direction, even if they were partial or, in fact, outright failures. You know, so in the discussion of what's sometimes called the Indian New Deal, you know, which is rooted in the Wheeler-Howard Act of 1934, we don't often remember this, but that's a centerpiece of the New Deal, as is its kind of cousin, the Taylor-Grazing Act of the same year. They both reverse the 19th century policies of breaking up land and parceling it out to individuals. First of all, there was the allotment policy, which sought specifically to break up native lands. And then there was the homesteading policy, which sought to break up the publicly claimed lands of the West. And the New Deal stops those things. And that right away tells us something about the New Deal. Again, we are getting rid of the old concept of individual initiative in favor of some sense of shared commonwealth. And in both cases, the New Deal sought to consult local populations about how to manage this reversal of that policy. With the grasslands, you know, they went to ranchers and they said, well, how many head do you normally graze? And then they also asked them, how many head do your neighbors normally graze? And they compared the disparities that they got and answered these questions. And they tried to come up with a fair outcome. But in the end, you had to make trade-offs. As the head of the New Deal Grazing Service said, you know, some people you're going to open the gate for, and other people you're going to kick them in the ear and tell them to go open a filling station. And that, of course, remains the thing that has kept the BLM unpopular among certain sets of ranchers today, right? And they tried to do the same thing with Native nations by first reversing the allotment policy and then saying we're going to recharter the Native nations to recognize their sovereignty again. But not all Native nations were happy with the level of consultation or even the process of rechartering. They felt that it was high-handed and paternalistic, and particularly in the case of the Navajos, as you pointed out, they were really quite adamantly opposed to the New Deal's methods of trying to get them to adopt a policy of new uses for grasslands in the Navajo Nation. Right. So there's a tremendous amount of friction. And in the end, you know, despite the investment in the Navajo Nation in the way of public works, despite the reinvigoration of the local infrastructure and the economy, there remained and indeed remains a great deal of antipathy towards the legacy of the New Deal in Navajo country for good reasons. So it's, as I say, at best, a partial success, maybe even an outright failure.
How did this become a concern of Roosevelt's and his administration's? In other words, it strikes me that it wouldn't be a great political benefit necessarily, right, to undertake these efforts. What were they trying to do? Was it a genuine kind of interest in trying to do better by these people? Did they think it would have, you know, certain economic benefits? How did it kind of fit into the larger constellation of what they were trying to do with the New Deal? How did this kind of become a concern of the administration's?
I think that both materially and ideologically it fit with the New Deal in a way that maybe it's not obviously clear to us today. But if we think about much of the New Deal, the kind of the mainstream, if you like, of the New Deal's public works programs as being about addressing obvious and critical deficiencies, that was certainly true in the policy towards the Indian New Deal, that there had been longstanding malign neglect in the relationship between the United States government and the Native nations. And there was a sense that just as a material policy for the welfare of the people there, the same with unemployed people anywhere, that that needed to be redressed. So when Roosevelt established the Civilian Conservation Corps in the first years, it was an obvious thing for folks in the Department of the Interior to say, and we need a Indian version of the Civilian Conservation Corps, which they immediately, you know, also established. I think that also for particularly the folks who were in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the Department of the Interior and John Collier, the controversial figure there, there was a clear ideological consistency between setting aside what he called planless individualism in the national economy and adopting a, you know, sense of shared commonwealth, getting rid of the old allotment policy and kind of re-instituting Native forms of government and Native practices. He saw a clear parallel there. So it was an opportunity, I think. And from a straightforward economic policy point of view, as you know, anytime you can reinvigorate any part of the economy, its purchasing power is a boon to the rest of the economy. And that was central to Roosevelt's way of looking at things, that you wanted to reinvigorate the purchasing power of all segments of the economy at once.
Yeah, to me, it was probably the most unexpected chapter in the book. Again, that might just be a commentary on my ignorance. And of course, as I mentioned, you also have the chapter on Hunter's Point in the San Francisco Bay Area. And that chapter really, again, is a chapter on African Americans in the New Deal. One way of asking the question would be, you know, if you're writing a book about the New Deal right now, you're going to have a chapter that addresses questions of racial justice, both the kind of positive aspects of the New Deal, the improvements it really offered African Americans, but also its noted failings. You know, given that I expected a chapter on that in this book, of all the different ways you could have approached it, what did you try to do in that chapter? And what were you trying to kind of explain to readers about the kind of complicated racial politics of the New Deal?
Well, quite often people will ask a question something like, wasn't the New Deal bad for Black people? And the short answer to that question is Black people in the 1930s didn't think so. Black voters became Democrats because of the New Deal. Not in 1932, mm-hmm. right? Not in 1932 when Roosevelt was simply making a lot of promises, but in 1936 when they had seen what he was going to deliver, right? That's when the big shift happens. Mm-hmm. And essentially the majority of black voters never go back, right? It's not that there are no black Republicans, but, you know, the majority of black voters become Democrats as a result of the New Deal. And so that's the first thing I think to point out. Okay, why do they do that? Well, the New Deal, when it's administered at the national level, so when you have a program like the Works Progress Administration, which is run by Harry Hopkins, you know, from the very beginning, it has a policy against racial discrimination in hiring, and eventually that becomes a statutory bar on racial discrimination against hiring. The Works Progress Administration sets wage expectations and working conditions that are better than what most black people can otherwise get. And many black people get into professional jobs because of the Works Progress Administration. This is something that the Urban League recognized again during the New Deal. Right. So you have Hopkins running the WPA out of Washington. It's the federal government actually hiring people. That can be an effective measure against discrimination. The same thing goes for the Public Works Administration, which is run out of the Department of the Interior under Harold Ickes. Ickes hired a black economist named Robert Weaver, who later would be the first African-American cabinet secretary under Lyndon Johnson. And Weaver, you know, basically set up a policy to prevent discrimination without trying to prove individual acts of bigotry, but just saying, look, if there's a pattern of discrimination against hiring, you know, you will suffer a penalty. So when you have those nationally run organizations, they tend to promote the welfare of black Americans, and black Americans recognize that. To go even beyond that, you know, from what we know about black Americans' voting preferences before the Roosevelt administration, even before the Great Depression, we know that that was a constituency that was largely in favor of, you know, more socially liberal policies. So the policies of the New Deal were more in line with what the policy preferences of black Americans were. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's important to point out that the Democratic Party in the 1930s is split. You know, the northern urban elements of the Democratic Party are ethnically diverse, even racially diverse. They're largely working class. They depend heavily on labor unions, which the New Deal, you know, fosters and promotes the welfare of through various bits of legislation that are highly successful. The southern wing of the Democratic Party is the Jim Crow disfranchisement wing of the Democratic Party. That is a one-party state where black people essentially cannot vote, that they keep themselves in power through the all-white primary system, so that it's only the primary elections that really matter in the South, and then the general elections are essentially a pro forma ratification of whoever the Democratic Party's all-white voters have chosen. Those guys don't like unions, because unions bring up raise wages.
Really?
They don't. It's shocking. Uh-huh. They don't like public works programs that have minimum wage requirements like the WPA or the PWA. And they're also very powerful within the Democratic Party because, given that the South is essentially a one-party state, you know, they have seniority in the Senate, and they become, you know, important figures in committees and things like that, and they have a tremendous amount of power. So they're in favor of money being directed towards their region as long as they can control how it's spent, and they're a big drag on any move towards social justice. They filibuster the proposed anti-lynching legislation whenever it comes up. And Roosevelt's cognizant of their power. You know, he has his son Jimmy talk to white Southern leaders in the Senate, say, how long are you going to keep this filibuster up? And they say, you know, indefinitely, which means that none of the other legislation is going to go through. Roosevelt cedes a lot to the Southern Democrats when you have a public works program like the Tennessee Valley Authority that, of course, is in the Tennessee River Valley and therefore in the South. Its works are segregated. You know, it's not that it doesn't employ black people. It's not even that it doesn't employ black managers, but its works are segregated. And it's very disappointing to black workers who, on the one hand, see the rhetoric about, you know, this is about building for the people, and on the other hand, feel like it's not quite for all the people or not equally for all the people. And maybe even worse, and this gets back to Hunter's point, you know, when the New Deal starts its mortgage backing programs in earnest, you know, it has real estate agents draw up the maps designating which neighborhoods are desirable to lend to. And of course, this is the beginning of what we know as the practice of redlining, which is identifying as undesirable places where you have a large black population. So when the New Deal is not national, when it's sort of outsourced to the local Democratic Party in the South or to private agencies, it's much less equitable. And in fact, it is inequitable. And that is part of its legacy. So Hunter's Point is, of course, one of those redlined neighborhoods, which is why I wanted to kind of begin there and kind of use that to set the scene and say that even though, you know, Black Americans, by large and for good reasons, you know, remain Democratic voters, they have been ill-treated in many respects by the Democratic Party. And Roosevelt, you know, to be fair, knew this. He spoke about this. And especially in the latter part of his second term, his Justice Department established a unit, which was first called the Civil Liberties Unit, and then was called eventually the Civil Rights Division, right, which is in charge of enforcing civil rights. One of the first cases they bring is to establish that the federal government can regulate primary elections, which is the beginning of the end for the white primary in the South. So, they, you know, they knew what they were participating in and moved to fight against it, even as they were compromising with it. So, but it was a tightrope that the administration walked, sometimes less gracefully than others.
Maybe that's a pessimistic note to end on, but we've kind of worked our way through the book. But maybe if you have any more hopeful comments to leave us with, the conversation's been really fascinating, Eric. And this to me was like, getting to sit in on a graduate seminar or a great lecture or something. The book was wonderful. You've been so generous with your time. And I do want to encourage all of our listeners to pick up a copy of Why the New Deal Matters. And I've maybe given enough filler here for you to come up with something hopeful to leave us with.
Well, I would just say, as you know, I've said in the book and that sort of deal with in the latter part of the book, that even people who are cognizant of the New Deal's mixed legacy on race, like, for example, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, are still optimistic about the power of the New Deal to inspire us. You know, she is one of the principal proponents of the idea of a Green New Deal. She's recently co-sponsored with Ed Markey the proposal for a civilian climate corps, whose initials, of course, obviously invoke the Civilian Conservation Corps and whose outlines do so. So I think that, you know, even folks who are quite aware of the failings of the New Deal are optimistic about its ability to kind of pull us together to meet a shared challenge like the climate crisis of our era.
I mentioned at the beginning of the book, you kind of trick the reader a little bit by giving a description that could either be the winter of 1932 or the winter we've just lived through. But it really, in a way that, apart from those kind of references, without being heavy-handed, to me, reading the book, I was impressed by kind of this effort to make our democracy more robust, including in ways that sometimes we don't think about. I mean, when we were talking about libraries and, you know, sponsoring music and theaters and things like that, a kind of really robust democratic political and public culture. The book is really just a beautiful, I think, meditation on that in some ways. And again, it was really lovely to read. And I hope everyone puts it on their summer reading list because, you know, now we're all vaccinated. Hopefully we'll be outside going to the beach, going on vacation. You know, it's maybe not the lightest beach read, but it's still only about 200 pages. And if listeners really love it, I encourage them to then go on to the Winter War. And if they're real, you know, Rausch Way heads, they can go back to the Moneymakers. The Moneymakers is one I haven't read yet. I hope to maybe get to it this summer. But I'm really grateful for your work, Eric, and for the time you took to talk about all this with me. I'm sure our listeners will love it.
Well, thank you very much. And as you say, we do need to remind ourselves what a broad conception of democracy would look like. As Roosevelt said, in a robust democracy, you don't just need enough to live on, you need something to live for. And that's something I think we can all believe in.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you.